Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, Cherokee County. This is Lynn Saunders, your host of Cherokee Conversations, and you are listening to 102.9 FM, otherwise known as MyGraceRadio.com. You might be listening in your car, on your phone, on your computer. It's all good. I'm just glad you're here, and welcome, welcome. Today, I am again welcoming my dear friend, retired Colonel Quentin Thomas. We had him on last week, as a matter of fact, as he talked about the Declaration of Independence. Thank you for joining me today.
My pleasure.
All right, today we're talking about the Constitution.
We are. Yes, ma'am. We're going to follow up. The two are connected, brother and sister, bookends, however you want to. There's a lot of controversy by historians that they're not. They are, in fact, connected. One describes the issues and one describes the solution.
As a recap of last week, just a
Yes.
tiny bit for those who were not part of that listening audience, the Declaration basically gave 27 issues that the
Yes.
colonies had problems with the crown, with Britain.
Yes, that's exactly right. The committee of five included Jefferson, Franklin, Adams, and others. And Jefferson was chosen. History covers it several different ways, but he was chosen to write the first draft, and his first draft was put forward. And his first draft is really interesting because it confirms to me that Jefferson wasn't near the deist that many contemporary historians would like to paint him as.
And so by deist, you mean what exactly?
Well, when I say deist as a historian, it's that God was a clockmaker and he made the clock, wound it up, started the pendulum, and walked off. Jefferson believed that God had a hand in hand. And as we're going to talk about here at the Constitution, you're going to find out that the other deist, Benjamin Franklin, may not have been nearly the deist that historians would like him to be. There's just a fear of adding the Christian flavor or of acknowledging their Christian faith. In fact, Jefferson said, "I am a Christian and a follower of the tenets of Jesus Christ." I mean, what would you tell someone if
That's
they
pretty,
ask you?
yeah,
That's
that's pretty clear.
pretty clear. So anyway, so we have moved forward from 6 years after the war. Washington and the Continental Army in 1781 scored their decisive victory with the help of the French at Yorktown. It resulted in Great Britain basically deciding that they would negotiate and allow the colonies their independence. In 1783, the Treaty of Paris was negotiated. You'll see these names keep popping up: Benjamin Franklin, John Jay, John Adams, Henry Lorenz went to England to negotiate the Treaty of Paris, and it absolutely sealed the deal that we were a sovereign nation, struggling, if you at best, heavy war debt. So throughout the war, we had operated under the Articles of Confederation and perpetual friendship. Now, I've always said that at best it was a gathering of individual states determined to remain loosely connected only for the purposes of fighting the war. And at worst, it was a group of independent states determined to prevent the other states from gaining an upper hand in governance while functioning on a volunteer basis, because it was truly that. It was a very loose association. It resulted in state-to-state issues. It resulted in not being able to fund the Revolutionary War. And of course, it resulted in other foreign nations looking at this newly formed nation as a potential for their expansion. So then you fast forward, though, as they had tried to operate under these articles and realized they couldn't do it.
So the Articles of Confederation,
Yes.
What were they and when were they written up?
They were written up early in the war, but they were more of a committee of states to try to perpetuate through the war. They didn't have much authority. It was a volunteer basis. People didn't attend. States were operating independently, and so they would bring them together and ask for money. And that's why you see Washington forever going to Congress, trying to get money, trying to get uniforms, trying to get support. And of course, you needed some type of nation. Remember that we, at the Declaration of Independence, they appointed a committee that would build some type of confederation so they could go to other nations for help, France.
So what came first, the Articles of Confederation or the Declaration of Independence?
Declaration of Independence.
Came first.
Yeah, the war came first.
Well,
Then the
yes.
declaration came, and
Right.
then the articles came.
Okay. And about what yearish was that?
Well, it was several years after the Declaration of Independence that they operated. We operated under it throughout the war.
Okay.
So it
Okay.
was less than satisfactory. And they're realizing this now that they've become an independent nation. They realize something has to be done. So they meet in 1786 at Annapolis to address the faults of the articles. And the meeting failed because there was not a quorum, because these states were reluctant to give up their independence, if you will. So Alexander Hamilton wrote an invitation, if you will, and said, hey, we need to get together. Maybe in May we'll get together in Philadelphia, 1787. And so that was sent out, and virtually all of the states, except Rhode Island, which became known as Rogue Island, because they never attended, and they were the last to. You'll find that they were the last to ratify the Constitution. But they met, the Georgia Assembly got the invitation, and on February the 10th of 1787, they elected six delegates to attend the convention: William Few, Abraham Baldwin, William Pierce, George Walton, William Houston. These are names that you will find scattered throughout the state, named in counties and towns and streets and so forth, and Nathaniel Pendleton. Now, all of them didn't sign, and we'll talk about that in a little bit. So, several of the delegates attended from Georgia infrequently. Some of them, they had businesses to attend to. Delegates were in and out of the convention. Alexander Hamilton was gone for 2 months of the 3 months of the convention, as an
Wow.
example.
Okay.
So, anyway, in March of that year, it was announced that George Washington would be a delegate from Virginia. That pretty well sealed the deal. That if George Washington was coming out of retirement, people knew that it was serious and they were going to attend. And that was the draw. And I think that Hamilton and Madison were very instrumental in coaxing Washington out of retirement to come and sit as a delegate. They convened on the 25th of May. They tried to convene earlier, couldn't get a quorum. Weather-wise, traveling and so forth was very difficult. But as they convened, Robert Morris, on behalf of Benjamin Franklin, who was also a delegate, Franklin was ill, and it was a had gout, terrible gout, and it was a rainy day, and he didn't attend the first day. But he had Morris nominate George Washington to be the chair. It was seconded. And then there is a story in history about how they proceeded to Washington as the delegate from Virginia. They escorted him to the dais. He sat in the sunrise chair as seated. It's really warming, the formality that they had and the reverence that they had for George Washington. So Madison, who will become known as the father of the Constitution, was seated nearby on the floor. He was not the official record keeper, but he kept the notes that have been passed on as the most complete and concise notes of the convention. We use those. In fact, I've never read William Jackson's notes because they really were not very complete. They also formed a rules committee, and so then they adjourned. And on Monday, the 28th of May, they came back together and they read some of the rules out that they had established. And I think they're interesting, so let me share a couple of them.
Okay.
They'd meet in secret. They would meet behind closed doors.
Why was that?
Well, there were several reasons. There were a number of newspapers in Philadelphia that would have loved to have known what this meeting of gentlemen from all across the colonies were doing, and they didn't want them to know. And they wanted to be able to change their opinion and maybe change their vote as more material came forward. And they didn't want to be accused at a later time of saying, well, you can't make up your mind. You don't know what you're doing. And the newspapers would have done that. The media would have done it. In fact, it's interesting that Madison said that his notes would never be revealed until all attendees were dead. And his
Wow.
notes were not published until, I think it was the 1840s, that they were finally published. And
Oh.
they're invaluable. They're just invaluable as to what really happened. So they said that you would act in a gentlemanly way. You wouldn't be reading a newspaper. You wouldn't be writing correspondence while others were speaking. You'd pay attention. You would address Washington You would not address the other delegate. If you were debating, even, you would not address them. You'd address Washington and be recognized. He would choose who would speak next if there was a tie. And then there would be an adjournment. When the adjournment was called, everyone would stand, Washington would leave the room, and then everybody else could leave. So there was a great formality to it. So they were behind closed doors for the whole entire meeting. The powers of the convention were discussed. Are we here to change the government? Are we here to modify the Articles of Confederation? And many people say, well, they acted in treason because of what they did. Thank goodness.
But in actuality, they were still having conflicts with Great Britain and hardships. Do you think that they were trying to intentionally, through all of these secret conversations, dissect what was right with the way Britain might have handled certain laws and issues, and what was wrong, and how to avoid conflict in what was common sense in one old culture to make sure that it didn't creep into the new culture that they were trying to create? Does that make sense?
I would think that if you had been a delegate, you took a copy of the Declaration of Independence with you and said, these are all the things we didn't like, and we need to fix these. And it comes in the end, you'll find that the Bill of Rights corrected a lot emphatically. There was opposition because many didn't think the Bill of Rights should be added. And then the logic to that was, why should we tell them what they can't do when we never gave the government permission to do it to begin with? And that's just pure logic, which tells you a lot about the enlightened mind.
Say that again, Quentin.
Well,
Say
the
that
logic
again.
was, why should we tell this new government what they can't do? Because that's what the Bill of Rights are. When in fact, we never gave them permission to do that to begin with.
Interesting.
Well, I think what they said is, tell them what you told them, tell them and tell them what you told them. And make sure it's clear. That's what really happened, the Bill of Rights. So on the May the 29th, Edmund Randolph of Virginia stood up and he proposed the Virginia Plan. Now that was developed by Madison. I'm not sure why Madison didn't do it. Doesn't make any difference though. It would, two houses of government would be elected by the people, 3-year terms. The second house would be composed of older leaders, which would be elected by the states. Legislators, 7-year terms, and both houses would have seats dividing them. The larger house would be measured on population. So that's kind of the rough draft that Madison threw out. Some stuck, some didn't. So they started the debate and they debated back and forth. And once, and the committee of a whole, they did everything by committee. Committee of a whole was, well, actually 12 delegates. Each state got one vote. So they had a lot of delegates, but they only got one vote. So the committee of a whole, as long as it was in operation, they could bring the subject back up. So you might find them debating the executive on the 15th of June. And if it never got resolved, they might be debating it again on the 15th of August. So until it got resolved, it was never resolved. They could always bring it back up. And I think that was part of the secrecy. What if Quentin Thomas was a delegate and I said, you know, we should have a 7-year term for the president. And then I get convinced that maybe a 4-year term is better. Then later on, I could say, well, I'll vote for the 4-year term and I won't be criticized for having changed my mind. And some of these folks got guidance from their state legislators. And of course, the Articles of Confederation Congress was meeting in New York simultaneously to the Federal Convention meeting in Philadelphia. So some of these people were delegates to both places back and forth. So they spent time on the road. Hamilton gave a 6-hour speech one time. That was his idea of the government. This was on the 18th of June. And one of the delegates said he was much respected, but seldom supported. And then it was right after that that Hamilton left and he didn't come back. So the whole thing became a big issue, a big knot. And they had a virtual deadlock until the end of June. Really a moment. This is a moment. I love this part especially because on the Thursday, the 28th of June, Dr. Benjamin Franklin, at 81 years old, the wise sage suffering from gout, who was transported to the convention in a sedan chair by four prisoners, stood and addressed the convention. Now, there are several accounts of this. My belief is that he spoke. Frequently, he would write something and have it read. I believe he said these words. He started to read his comments. "Mr. President, the small progress we have made after 4 or 5 weeks of close attendance and continual reasoning with each other, our different sentiments on almost every question, several of the last sentiments producing as many no's as yeas, is methinks a melancholy proof of the imperfection of human understanding." What he's saying is, boys, you've been messing around a long time and you hadn't gotten much done. Maybe we ought to reflect. And he then said, and this is in part, this is not completely, but you can read it. It's called Franklin's Prayer. "How has it happened, sir, that we have not hereto once thought of humbly applying to the Father of Lights to illuminate our understandings?" He said, "We did this at the Declaration of Independence Congress, and it worked, and that's why we're here today. So maybe we should turn and look at this." And he goes on to say that the more convincing proof I see of this truth of the Father of Lights, that God, all caps, God, he underlines it twice, governs in the affairs of men. And like I say in his original text, he underlines God, capital G. This is a deist who doesn't believe God participates in the day-to-day activities of man.
Supposedly,
He goes
supposedly.
on, he said, "If God can see a sparrow cannot fall to the ground without his notice, is it probable that an empire can raise without his aid? We have been assured, sir, in the sacred writings that except the Lord build the house, they labor in vain that build it."
Right.
Whoa, I love it. Said, "I firmly believe this, and I also believe that without his concurring aid, we shall su not succeed in politically building, basically. Therefore, I beg leave and move that henceforth we have assistance from heaven and that we have prayers here from heaven." Okay. Well, you would think they would all be, since they were all Christian men, you would think they would jump right on that. Well, Hamilton jumps up and Hamilton says, "You know, it's a little late to be asking for, quote, foreign aid." Quote, that's what Hamilton said. And so it was not well received. There was a Presbyterian minister there who voiced the strongest argument, Hugh Williamson of North Carolina. He noted that the convention had no funds, therefore we couldn't offer to pay somebody. I think these are pretty lame excuses if you want to know the truth. So anyway, it was not approved. So they adjourned. And then Washington later on told James Madison that a spirit of accommodation was happily infused into the leading characters, allowing them to work through their differences. Members would later use words like miracle, finger of the Almighty, finger of God, providence, superintending power to describe the spirit and energy that seemed to prevail over the convention following the little scolding, if you will, that Franklin gave those delegates. And he could do that. At 81, he was the oldest. And I think it was a fatherly talk that, boys, we are all Christian. We should look at this and we should remember what we're here for. So you need to note that it was right before the 4th of July celebration,
Oh, yeah, that's true.
28th of June. And they were cognizant that they were in the same room where the declaration had been signed. So they took a break. They met a little and they took a break and they came back on the 5th of July, the day after. And they
Okay.
celebrated just as John Adams had told Abigail they would. Now, he thought it was going to be the 2nd, remember? And they had shows and they had all kinds of fireworks and cannons and so forth. And George Washington was there. How appropriate was that? Many of the delegates had signed both. So the comments had a moderating influence, obviously. And the local clergy had spoken over the weekend about guidance to the convention, praying for their guidance, praying for their involvement and compromise and so forth. And so they came back with a different attitude. George Washington said they came back. I'm not making that up. But they had celebrated the 4th of July. The weekend allowed for a little cooling of passions. And sure enough, on the 5th, they came back with what has been known by several names as the Connecticut Compromise, the Great Compromise of 1787, or the Sherman Compromise, because Roger Sherman presented it. And it said, we need an upper house, we need a lower house, we need an executive, and so forth. And it really took the bones that Madison had presented originally
Yeah.
and gave them some flesh, and they moved on.
Yeah.
They moved on in a compromise, broke the deadlock, they moved together, single executive, the Electoral College, the election, definition, terms of office, the establishment of the Supreme Court. And so the final format was decided, and five members of a committee were appointed, the Committee of Style and Arrangement, and the afternoon of the 8th. And so then the evening of the 11th, the committee reworked the document that they had been given and crafted it. And Gouverneur Morris, who is one of the most colorful members, he's a peg leg ladies' man of some renown. He's identified by his biographer, Richard Brookhiser, as the rake who wrote the Constitution. So there's
The
color there. So there's color there. And so Gouverneur Morris is given the task of writing, bringing it to form, bringing it to form. Colorful man, imposing stature, like I say, had peg leg that he lost in an accident. His efforts, though, resulted in the original preamble. And
Oh.
so he took all the individual states that had been listed and so forth that were there, and he compressed them into what we know as we, the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, et cetera, et cetera. Some historians allege that Morris carefully selected and arranged words and punctuations that he thought, and allowing him to artfully quote, artfully bend some of the meanings to some of his own views. Some say he even admitted it in later life that he had massaged it a little bit, and we don't care. He did is he presented the convention with work and in language, and he's credited as having been very capable of doing all of this. One of the few writers that could do it. Monday, the 17th of September, the engrossed copy was formatted, presented to the individuals there. They read it. Three delegates refused to sign no Bill of Rights. They'd been there, and they left. They eventually came around, and the Bill of Rights, of course, was added. William Few and Abraham Baldwin were the only two members of the Georgia delegation that were there. They signed, and then it was sent to the Articles of Confederation Congress meeting in New York, said, "Boys, here's what we've done. See what you think of it." They
Yeah.
debated it about 3 days and sent it to the states for ratification. And it was ratified by state convention, and that's the important part. So Georgia ratified in 1788, January the 2nd, became the fourth state to ratify. New Hampshire became the ninth state, and they said it only takes nine states. And so then we move forward, and of course, Rhode Island was the very last to ratify. And interestingly enough, Rhode Island never attended any meeting of the convention. So today it remains the shortest written constitution in the history of the world. And we have only 27 changes that have been made. One amendment reversed a previous amendment. And we are blessed with a constitution that is truly the envy of the world. And it is being implemented by a Judeo-Christian philosophical approach. And that's why it's so successful.
And here it is. Well, quite 250 years for
It
the
will be the
Constitution.
17th of September that we will celebrate Constitution Day.
Wow, so much history packed into a half
Isn't
hour.
that
It's so fun, and I have so many questions. I just
fun?
trying not to interrupt you because it would take a part three to get through
No.
the whole story.
Yeah. Maybe in September we'll do a part three. Where
Maybe we'll do a part.
we've come from.
Well, there you go. I like
All
that.
right.
So, Quentin, please tell people about the classes that you teach coming up in the fall that
Okay.
are interested and how they might contact you.
KSU has the Osher Lifelong Learning Institute. You can go on the KSU website and get that. I'll be teaching Wednesdays that and the profiles of the founders. So you'll know more about Gouverneur Morris and Roger Sherman and some of these people, and certainly our representatives from Georgia. I also teach over in Roswell at the Senior Enriched Learning, SEL, and it is adult education. These are programs for 50 and older. They're really fun because these folks bring life experiences to the class, and many are extremely well read. They often complete the sentence that I start. or remind me of the last name or some of that stuff. So it's really, and I've been doing this for years and years, and I miss it in the summer, but I need the summer to get ready for the fall. So I'll be teaching one class on Wednesday morning and one class on Thursday morning called Profiles of the Founders. So I think that's appropriate during this 250th year celebration. So
Fantastic.
get out and celebrate our country.
Amen.
All
Thank you,
right.
my friend. Thank
All
you.
right.
And for all that you do and all the teaching, and because it does take time and digging, and I know that you do love it, so it's not work, but for someone like me and for the listeners who have tuned in and been taking notes like I have been, it's a real gift to have the ability to have a pitch and catch conversation with somebody like yourself to fill in some of those holes. American
I you might remind them I speak for free.
There you
Now, in some cases, lunch is good, but I will speak for free.
go. Okay. With that note, I'm going to say thank you again
You bet.
and enjoy the rest of your day. And listeners, thank you for staying with the show for the half hour. And I hope you'll tune back in next week. God
All
bless.
right. Thank you, Lynn.
My pleasure.